Our third presenter this afternoon is Venus Bivar. Venus completed her PhD in history at the University of Chicago in 2010. Her dissertation was entitled The Ground Beneath Their Feet, Agricultural Industrialization and the Remapping of Rural France, 1945 to 1976, which she is currently revising for publication. She has published a book chapter on a related subject and a 2006 article in the International Journal of Cultural Property called History for Sale, the International Art Market, and the Nation State. After graduating, Venus held a Mellon postdoctoral fellowship at the University of California, Berkeley from 2010 to 2012, after which she took up her current post at Washington University in St. Louis as an assistant professor of history. Venus has given her remarks for us today the title Piketty and the Promise of Postwar Growth.
Thank you. thanks for coming, everyone. I kept my remarks relatively short, hoping that there would be an active discussion after the roundtable is over. I was actually in charge of a History of Capitalism reading group for faculty last year on campus, and when this book came out and became such a hot topic, we decided to sub that in for the last session, and I read the whole thing dutifully as the convener of the workshop and rolled up to the discussion to learn only that one other faculty member had read the book. So, I'm hoping we have a better ratio today. I also brought the book so we can, as did Javam, so good.
In English.
In English, yes. all right, so, my current book project, as was just revealed, is about the meteoric rise of French agriculture to the upper echelons of global capitalism. And just as I'm finishing this up, Piketty's book has forced me to rethink this narrative in a couple of fairly important ways. And so rather than viewing the rejigging of the French economy after the Second World War as a function of political will, I have to think about it as well as a function of economic instability, right? So one of the major theses of the book is that the decimation of wealth during the two world wars and the Great Depression created a greater openness in terms of economic opportunity, possibilities for growth, reconfiguring assets, how people accumulate wealth, etc. So I've had to think about that a little bit in terms of how French agriculture developed after the war. I'm sure many of us here have read about Jean Monnet and his famous five-year plans, but thinking as well about what Piketty's book means for Monet and planification in the post-war period. So that's just, basically this talk is that I'm giving is I'm just going to throw you a bunch of questions and see what sticks. So that's the first point. beyond this moment then, at the end of the Second World War, when there was massive economic instability, Piketty also has forced me to reconsider things in terms of the time period that most of us refer to as les Trente Glorieuses. So this period of unprecedented growth that follows the Second World War and begins to peter out in the 1970s with the oil crisis. And in thinking about the post-war narratives that have dominated much of the historiography in the last 15 years, 10 years, we don't necessarily tell this story as one of progress, but it's difficult not to read it that way. And so I was thinking about Kristin Ross's Fast Cars, Clean Bodies, Coisel's Seducing the French, even Laurence Wiley's Village in the Vaucluse, right? These all tell a story about increasing comforts in the home, different kinds of social groups being incorporated into a mass consumer society. By no means, of course, closing the wealth gap, but telling a story about greater opportunities for more people. So one of the big questions here, I guess, is what does Piketty and his book do for us in thinking about this time period, right? If it is just an anomaly instead of a new trend, how do we re-understand that story? It might become something of like a Garden of Eden, right, from which we are all destined to fall. That was fairly pessimistic. moving on. I am also going to draw your attention to the H. France Salon that recently featured a number of interesting historians talking about Piketty's work. And here I want to quote from Mary O'Ferner's contribution. I think she does a nice job of summarizing the relationship between growth and consumption that Piketty talks about in the book. And this goes back to what I was just saying about Les Trente Glorieuses as being this period of mass consumption and the efflorescence of the middle class. So Ferner writes, quote, "In a slow growth situation, a lot of saving in combination with a low or declining demand for labor leads to ever larger accumulations of capital and thus to an ever larger income share going to the investor slash asset owning class. As the income from capital rises faster than the overall growth of the economy, demand for goods and services is unable to support a level of consumption that can sufficiently boost wages to offset the flow of income to capital." So in short, what she's saying here is that mass consumption can really only be sustained by high levels of growth, right? and so if slow growth is the norm, as Piketty is telling us in his book, average of 1% over the history of humanity, or as Rachel just pointed out, only 4% globally in the post-war period, if slow growth is the norm, what happens to our understanding of this moment in the 20th century that we've defined by mass consumption and late capitalism? And so if it's not late capitalism, what is it exactly, right? So more of a historiographical question for thinking about how we periodize these moments in French history. And here I was actually thinking about the last couple of decades. My research tends to end in the middle of the 1970s, but thinking about the rise of massive consumer debt and thinking about how this new mass consumer moment in the post-war period is something that people became used to and took for granted as a new standard, right, rather than as a blip in history, and so therefore leveraged themselves into massive amounts of debt in order to continue an historical moment that Piketty is telling us is in fact nothing that we can expect to enjoy forever, right? That it was just a few decades of fun, a Keynesian party, if you will. That was an economics joke, nobody got it. Anyways, there's a great rap video on YouTube, has anybody seen this, of, you've seen it? Yeah, exactly. So one guy plays Hayek and one guy plays Keynes, and Keynes like this party animal who's like doing drugs at the disco, and Hayek is like, you gotta stop partying. Anyways, moving on. Look it up. It's great. The students love it. My new book project is about economic growth in the 20th century as a category of analysis, both for economists and also for politicians. Super interesting. Economic growth didn't exist as a phrase before the 1930s, was barely used until the 1950s, and now has become absolutely ubiquitous. It's all we ever talk about. Open up the newspaper. Economic growth in India recently has been in the New York Times. Of course, Obama's constantly talking about job growth, stimulating growth, etc. and so reading Piketty has also forced me to think about this project in new ways. And in my reading, this book is really about growth. He's talking about how capital grows, what the consequences of that growth are, and how political systems can intervene to mitigate those consequences, the unsavory consequences of that growth. So again, Piketty in general is telling us that capital grows quite slowly, but steadily. And I think this is actually quite interesting. On page 116 in the text, he says that while capital might start out as being risk-oriented and entrepreneurial, quote, "it always tends to transform itself into rents as it accumulates in large enough amounts. That is its vocation and its logical destination." And so because the return on these rents will always be higher than the return on labor, which, if anything, is the central thesis of this text, the gap between whose income is based on investment and those whose income is based on labor or salary is always going to expand, right? And for Piketty, as both of my co-panelists have already pointed out, this is morally unacceptable. And then he spends the last third of the book talking about how you might remedy this inequality through taxation or better access to higher education, among other things. So this connection between growth and inequality, I think is something that we should continue to think about. I'd be curious to hear what you guys have to say in the audience. And it is going to be central to this next project that I'm taking up. And just to get the ball rolling then, in my own research, I've seen these two things related at different scales. And so on the domestic scale, of course, tax cuts justified in the 1980s leading to growth, right, that would eventually lead to greater consumption, investment, et cetera, that would benefit the salaried and laboring classes. On a global scale, very interesting things are happening in the world of development in the post-war period, so that metropoles, former metropoles, are providing all kinds of development aid to the third world in a way to paper over very serious global inequalities in wealth and power, promising that that aid will in fact close the gap between global, between the first and third worlds. As we know, in 2015, neither of these things played out along those lines. And many would say that in fact, the inequalities that these two policies were supposed to correct have in fact grown worse, right? Piketty would certainly argue that they've grown worse. Or Paul Krugman, the fat cat in the suit giving interviews. So maybe I'll just end that idea about inequality and growth by saying that I think one of the important things that he does, which is perhaps not terribly interesting for historians, but is perhaps more interesting for economists if they pay attention, is that politics is really the only way to remedy the unsavory effects of the economy, right? But that it cannot be left to the economy to simply grow and lift all boats. I was reading a review recently of Piketty, and there was a great line in it that said, it was only lifting the yachts. And I am going to end with three questions that I will just let hang. So the first one, given that the history of capitalism has become such a thing, mostly with American historians, but is beginning to flip over to Europe as well, what does Piketty's book do for the history of capitalism? Capitalism typically gets depicted as this dynamic, ever-changing system that is possibly even heading towards its own self-destruction, right? But if Piketty's interpretation of capital is correct, that it is in fact risk-averse in general and that it will logically tend toward rent-seeking behavior, what does this do to the kinds of questions that people have been asking about capitalism in the 19th and 20th centuries? I think that we've been focused very much on the dynamic aspects of capitalism, thinking about growth, modernity, how the United States became such a global powerhouse, the Gilded Age, et cetera. What kinds of different questions might we ask if we're thinking about capital as a conservative measure to maintain inequality and wealth accumulation? Second question. Is about democracy. So this is more in the third part of the book, but Piketty he suggests that the survival of democracy is really contingent on our ability to manage this disparity between growth and inequality. So if we have less growth, greater inequality, and an erosion of democracy. And I think he's really interested in trying to figure out how to maintain some kind of democratic politics in light of slow growth that we've been experiencing since the 1970s. And here I might also ask you to think about the role of the middle class, right? So thinking about capitalism, the growth of capitalism, late capitalism, mass consumption, whatever you want to call it, we've often put the middle class at the center of that story as a way to buffer the gap between the wealthy and the not wealthy. Of course, the press these days is full of stories about the eroding middle class. So as a category for historians, what happens to the middle class in light of this different understanding of growth and the development of capital? And here I was thinking about Elizabeth Cohen's Consumer's Republic. So if the republic is no longer based on consumption and the relationship between citizens and the market, what will it be based on in the future? And then the last question I will ask is about the relationship between globalization and inequality. Piketty does not bring this up himself in the book, but it doesn't seem to be a coincidence that The shift between high growth and low growth happens in the 1970s at a moment when globalization really takes off. And that the period of Les Trente Glorieuses was one of relative protectionism in terms of economic trade. Trade was limited largely to regional networks rather than global networks. So with that exploding in the 1970s, is there some kind of relationship to be drawn between the end of this anomalous growth period that Piketty talks about and a renewed surge of globalizing economic activity? And I will leave it with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our final presenter this afternoon is Jotham Parsons. Jotham completed his PhD in history in 1997 at Johns Hopkins University. Thereafter, he taught at the University of Delaware and at Roosevelt University in Chicago, before taking up a position at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, where he is currently Associate Professor of History. He is well published and has produced two monographs, The Church and the Republic, Gallicanism and Political Ideology in Renaissance France, with the Catholic University of America Press in 2005, and Making Money in 16th Century France, Currency, Culture, and the Modern State, with Cornell University Press in 2014. Notably, Jotham is also the third member of our panel today who has held the Gustave Gimond Visiting Scholar Fellowship at Stanford University Libraries. So, Venus, there's an opportunity there for
I'm a 20th
century.
I have no holdings. I've looked.
You need background.
He has given his reflections this afternoon the title Sully Redivivus, Piketty and the Deep History of French Political Economy.
Thank you. And I now regret that title, seeing that Dan Smale's in the audience, but I will try not to embarrass him. So yes, I'm going to return in some ways to the themes that Julia began with, and particularly the relationship of Piketty's project and this book to the French cultural traditions that go back into the 18th century and beyond, into the old regime. But in my case, in the register, not so much of political culture, but of political economy and even of sort of economics more narrowly defined. And what I want to suggest is that some of the central themes of the book grow out of the specific circumstances of old regime France, which continue in different ways to operate in French culture today. If Tocqueville was right about anything, and I think he was right about many things, it was about the deep continuities in French political culture across the revolutionary divide, so that even someone like Piketty, whose horizons explicitly go only into the 19th century, can easily, sometimes unwittingly, be influenced by what came before. And in particular, the socioeconomic structures and economic thought of the old regime had before the 19th century long made the stratification of wealth, its tax treatment, and its intergenerational transfer central problems of political economy. So when these things appear in Piketty and appear new to many of, particularly his American readers, to scholars of early modern France, they appear in many ways very traditional. And so wealth, le patrimoine, those things that belong to the pater and perhaps to the patrie, is a far more evocative term, as you all know in French, than mere capital. Two aspects of wealth, as Piketty understands it, tie it closely and explicitly to the deeply patrimonial world of the old regime. So Piketty's wealth is agnostic as to technology or the means of production, and notably including a large and, Piketty thinks, quite possibly increasing proportion of landed rents. And it's transgenerational, so that its mode of transmission has profound implications for social and economic structures. This appears in the book most clearly in the frequent and oft remarked by reviewers references to the novels of Balzac, Austen, and others. But it speaks of a Weltanschauung that goes much deeper than the high school literary curriculum. The old stereotype that contrasts a static, agrarian, and rentier France to a dynamic, industrial, and commercial England is certainly overdrawn, but it's not entirely without foundations. And those foundations, to the extent that they're real, go back at least into the late 16th and early 17th centuries, when Elizabeth I's advisors favored manufacturing and overseas projects, while Sully and others prioritized agriculture and domestic reconstruction. And it's not without significance that this is one of the few facts of old regime political economy that has consistently appeared in the curricula of French schools back into the early 19th century again. There's some things about the structure of the old regime that we tend to forget just because they were so constantly present, but they help us to appreciate the naturalness of Piketty's approach. No one back then doubted that the nobility was the foundation of the monarchy, but the nobility in turn, as everybody also knew, was constituted by the financial strategies of its component families. Works like those of Denis Richer in France or Bob Forster in the US and countless others who've followed in their footsteps have taught us an enormous amount about how that process of transfer and strategy worked, and much about those strategies could be applied to any society dominated by highly unequal wealth, which, as Piketty notes, have been far more the rule than the exception throughout human history. That was certainly the case in the Belle Époque, for which Piketty supplies much good data. So it occurs to me as I read this that much of the pathos of À la recherche du temps perdu, which could easily have taken a place among Piketty's literary examples, derives from the surprising viability of nominally unreconstructed aristocrats in the era of high modernism. The difference, of course, was that under the Third Republic, those family structures had been formally decoupled from the structure of the state. Piketty frequently cites the first article of the Déclaration des droits de l'homme, that men are born and remain free and equal in rights, and social distinctions may be founded only on the common utility. The social distinctions of the old regime were instead founded on and maintained by the monarchy itself, for which the nobility in turn provided crucial support in a complex web that Bill Baik and others have done so much to detail. This meant that both the return on noble wealth, the return on capital in the old regime, and its distribution within society and across generations were matters of constitutional significance. This in turn had an impact on French political economy and political and culture that continues to endure down to today. So not to get too deep into the weeds, but this was clear even in the very earliest works of French political economy from the era of Sully and Henri IV. Barthélemy Lafamas, Louis de Maillan-Torquay, and Antoine de Montchrétien all in slightly different ways attacked France's agrarian, patrimonial, and aristocratic orientation and advocated greater economic and social rewards for labor and manufacturing. This expanded in several of their works into a broad socioeconomic critique. For example, in Turquet's call for a meritocracy in filling royal offices and, quote, admitting therein and reserving by pure authority nobles and non-nobles according to the quality of the charge and the capacity and merits of each. Or, more relevantly for our purposes, in Montchrétien's call for a systematic French census in the Roman style, where, quote, everyone will declare his goods and make known what his revenue is, which would be, quote, the best means to provide for the just complaints of the poor against the rich by simplifying and rationalizing the fiscal system. Though Montchrétien went almost entirely unread, that nexus of wealth, taxation, and political justice was omnipresent in early modern France. The original wealth tax, the taille, marked in many ways the emergence of the old regime itself and signaled down to 1789 its articulation of nobility, state service, and wealth. The most technical, but in many ways the most revealing debates around this were attached to the taille réelle, under which noble exemptions from the taille inhered in properties rather than their owners. Endlessly litigated in Dauphiné and above all in Provence, the taille réelle raised irresolvable issues about what kind of wealthy elite France wanted and what role government policy could or should take in shaping and maintaining that elite. These debates became all the more acute in the 18th century as voices increasingly arose to argue that the monarchy ought to, or perhaps needed to, include the privileged orders in the tax base. Vauban's 1707 project for a dîme royale, which does get a passing mention by Piketty, called for a kind of hybrid wealth and income tax that would fall on national productive capacity. Something of a pioneer in fiscal theory, Vauban advocated his system as economically efficient and socially just, and I quote, since all those who make up a state need its protection, it's reasonable that all contribute to its expenses and upkeep according to their revenues. Nothing then is so unjust as to exempt from this contribution those in the best position to pay it, just to throw off its weight onto the least well off. The constant emphasis on revenue, which, as Piketty repeatedly and very correctly points out, was under the conditions of a wealth-dominated economy, almost interchangeable with capital, underlines the continuities between this debate and Piketty's concerns. As you all know, this was a discourse that continued through the 18th century, playing a crucial role in the debates that spawned the revolution. More abstract economic thought, too, often orbited around similar issues. To take one example, the theories of Quesnay and the physiocrats were designed very explicitly, simultaneously, to improve the yields of the royal tax system and both the capital stock and the return on capital of landed proprietors. Quesnay shared Vauban's views on taxation, which he said should be established directly on the revenue of proprietors. But for him, this was a secondary consideration. Basically, like Piketty, Quesnay was concerned to understand and govern a society governed by accumulated capital. But he came to praise it rather than to bury it. This patrimonial fiscal complex, as one might call it, is perhaps the deepest and most profound legacy of the old regime to Piketty's thought, but it's not the only one. And for the sake of brevity, I'll conclude just by throwing out a few more largely unsupported ideas. No doubt those present will be able to supply more and probably better examples. So one thing that struck me and seems to have struck other economic historians reading Capital in the 21st century is the very rather small role that institutional structures play in Piketty's story. That actually shows up in that same H. France Salon article that Venus just quoted. In a field that, at least in the English-speaking world, the field of economic history is rather dominated by the new institutional economics, so to us this seems pretty odd. But perhaps in the French context it is less so. After all, if there was one area where Louis XIVian absolutism, Jacobin republicanism, and Bonapartist authoritarianism all agreed, it was on strongly, if sometimes not very successfully, subordinating all of the corps intermédiaires to the state and to the national collectivity. And if you combine that vue d'Arnault with the anti-humanist idealism of Anglo-American neoclassical economics, you can easily get a picture like the one that Piketty gives you. Another of Piketty's assumptions, also somewhat strange to American ears, and this gets back to what Rachel was just talking about, is that demographic changes will result in a substantially lower rate of economic growth going forward. This is not a peculiar idea of Piketty's. It's a widely held belief with lots of different roots, particularly in empirical demographic studies, but it is one that Americans often don't share, but it certainly fits into the strong French tradition of pronatalism, which goes again at least as far back as the physiocrats, and even into the French tradition of a kind of demographic panic that we see particularly whenever Germany gets a little bit stronger. and one could certainly talk also about, and this would link again into the cultural things that Julia was talking about, one could talk about the literary heritage of the novels of class and wealth and inheritance that Piketty discusses. Again, obviously these are themes which have very, very deep roots in French literature and again tie deeply into a wide variety of cultural concerns that that orbit around this book. But I think I've already gone on long enough, so I will stop there and leave the rest to the audience.